Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. Thanks to Tony Barnfield for the last hour. And now you have myself, Matt Bentman, and Rosie Applin with you for an hour of food and drink. And with Alan away this week, Rosie, would you care to do the honours and tell us what's on today's programme?
Well, today we have food writer and historian Bea Wilson talking about diet and cooking skills. Heidi White gives us the latest booking information for the Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival, along with details of one or two of the more unusual events. It starts this coming Friday.
Okay, and we also have a visit to a coffee roaster in Cambridge. Now, they've been roasting for over three decades, and we also hear from Gemma Whiting of Linton Kitchen about how she set about establishing a really successful business in a nearby village, and also about her Foraging by Punt event, which she has organised especially for Eat Cambridge 2018.
And during the programme, we'll be bringing you the foodie tweets we're receiving, and we'll also let you know what free food is available from the Olio app at the moment.
Okay, so let's begin with Linton Kitchen, which Alan visited earlier in the week.
Gemma, we're here at Linton Kitchen. What sort of food do you do here?
So we try and keep it local and seasonal. We change our menu every day. We look at the weather, take into account temperature and stuff like that. We do breakfasts all day, light lunches, quiche soup. One of the big favourites at the moment are the Scotch eggs, which is one of the only things we buy in. And they're from the kitchen, who's just down the road.
Right. And before you opened, which was how many years ago?
We just celebrated our fifth birthday.
Right, well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
But before you opened, there wasn't a cafe in Linton.
No, so I was working at Urban Larder in town and had been looking for a premises for a couple of years. And everyone thought I was mad opening out here. But we've got the luxury of having the monopoly because there's nothing else nearby. The closest place to get a coffee is the Gogs, which didn't actually have a cafe at the time, I don't think, or Saffron Walden or Central Cambridge. And Linton's a really big community. It's not just the, you know, chocolate box high street you see. We've got a big doctor surgery, four schools, pharmacist, dentist, co-op. So actually it's a really well-used, well-served village.
But there must have been some worry on your part that maybe you wouldn't get enough custom to keep going.
I was very young and I think I was just very gung-ho. Like, I saw that there was a niche. I'd heard lots of people about, you know, saying, oh, it would be nice to get a coffee around here. I did do a lot of research as well. I did a lot of research on, you know, the demographic of the area and the population of the area. So I just took an educated punt. I'd been in the industry for 10 years, so.
Right, when you say you looked at the demographic, I mean, how did that affect what you did?
The aim of this cafe was to, whilst we're a rural cafe, I wanted it, the produce, to reflect and hold its own if you were to put it in a city. So whether it's London or Cambridge or, you know, another city in the world that I've worked in, like Sydney or Brisbane. And there's a lot of people here who've moved out of London, who've moved out of Cambridge to start a family. There's lots of the older generations who've downsized to this location because of its amenities. And yeah, lots of commuters and stuff like that. So it's kind of people who are used to getting coffee as an affordable luxury in the city live here now. So just like I do, I moved out. I've lived in cities for 10 years and I now live here. So I like to be able to get...
Yeah. That's interesting. And do you feel, or do your customers feel, that village life is enhanced by you being here? Do people sort of run into people they might not otherwise see? Is there a lot of chatting goes on?
Yeah, so the idea behind the name, the Linton Kitchen, is because I grew up in a house, or houses, where the back door was always open. There was always a tin of cake. There was always the kettle on. You always could have a nice dinner. And I wanted to create the same, like just an open door policy. We have communal seating. And it's really worked. We have people who come in every day, old, young, you know, a lot of new families, new parents come here for their first outing. Old people come here and get their lunch every day. It really has been a really lovely community feel. And the communal seating has worked even better than I'd hoped, in that people get chatting straight away.
But there is also a quality to what you make because, for example, you sell to other cafes, don't you?
We do, yes. So last year we started to supply our cakes to both Hot Numbers Coffee in town. We've had lots of other inquiries, but to be honest, we're full to the hilt. But yeah, we try and keep it interesting and do things a bit differently. And it's not only about how good it looks, it's also got to taste really good. And we work hard to work with interesting suppliers. So we've just started working with the organic, or she's trying to become organic, vegetable grower up in Hildesham, and she started to supply Michelin starred chef. She started up last year, so her produce is just exceptional. So it might only be salad leaf, but it really is, the difference is really noticeable. So you can make simple food, but because you're using good ingredients, it's really tasty.
So what's your next move then? Are you going to expand or take over the world or what?
So I do have a sideline. We've just set up a company called Kokofune. I've done that in collaboration with Anna's Flower Farm, who's a flower grower at Audley End. And we're launching at Eat Cambridge. We've got a fringe event, which is a twilight foraging workshop on a punt because it's in Cambridge. And then we're going to be making a tapas meal out of the wild ingredients. So the idea is producing experiential events just as a real luxury, take away, you know, the hard work of organising for
that's a great
people.
Idea. And there is lots of stuff to be foraged at the moment as well.
Yeah, there is. We're actually doing a recce tomorrow night, a self punt unfortunately, down the riverbank to see what we've got. We've got really exciting things like elderflower fritters, and we're making them use of the lovely fresh nettles and hawthorn, and
lots of jack by the hedge at the
jack
moment,
by the
actually.
Hedge, yeah, exactly. Alexander's.
Okay, thanks very much, Gemma.
Well, that was all really impressive, and the foraging on a punt sounds great fun.
Mm.
A reminder that it's happening on the 31st of May from 5:30 till 9:30 p.m. The online Eat Cambridge brochure will take you to all the booking details. Gemma Whiting is doing another Eat Cambridge event, details of which are on our feature in a few minutes' time.
Okay, so on to our next feature. This is about Bea Wilson. Now, Bea is an author of currently, I believe, 5 food books, and they include titles such as The Story of the Honeybee and Us and Consider the Fork. She stopped by to chat with Tina Roche and Liz Young of the Cambridge Cookery and Bistro as part of their regular flavour feature that they do for us. It's kind of a conversation with regular guests each time on a monthly basis, talking about food, all things about food.
So, Bea, I have read with huge pleasure some of your books, including Consider the Fork, and this is not a diet book. But for me, the most fascinating was the more private one, First Bite. So I'm an only child, and I never had to compete for food with any siblings. And I found your description of the dinner table sort of power plays between you and your 2-year-old older sister absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I think it started at birth. That other person sitting at the table affects you and how you eat in all these ways that we somehow don't talk about and don't think about. There were things I kind of hadn't thought about for years about the extent to which my eating was formed by her. So one of the things I wrote about was that when she was a teenager, she became anorexic. And it was this terrible thing that this person I'd previously been sharing plates of spaghetti bolognese with, well, latterly not, because she'd gone vegetarian before she became anorexic, suddenly just was there with an empty plate. And I became a compulsive eater as a teenager. And I hadn't really examined until I wrote that book the extent to which that was clearly a reaction. It was partly my parents really were desperate for someone to feed. And I was really happy to be that baby bird sitting in the nest with my mouth gaping open, ready to have worms ferried in. But it also felt like it was a reaction against my sister. And it was sort of, we'd always had sibling rivalry going along. She had a rabbit, I had a guinea pig. She underate, I overate. And it's not as simple as that.
But you're also suggesting that maybe you also did it too. Somehow you felt sorry for your parents to a degree. You were aware of their anxiety over the one daughter who wasn't eating, and therefore you thought that you could be the good one and maybe ease that worry and that pain a bit.
I was somehow trying to compensate, because it's an awful dynamic. Any family that's seen anyone go through anorexia, to see someone that you love wasting away is terrible. I mean, it's obviously more terrible for her. I'm not trying to say being the person living with an anorexia, but it's eating disorders are so complex. And one of the things I just wanted to examine is how all of our experiences with food are formed by those first family moments. You know, as babies, whether we're only children or whether we have siblings, we're given both love and food at the same time when our mothers feed us with milk. And so it's no wonder that when we're adults, we sometimes have trouble disentangling whether sugar is actually love or something else.
And what do you think, Liz? Because you're another one of two sisters. Do you remember similar scenarios?
My sister was a very, very picky eater, so I don't think we ever had to compete in that sense. I was always the child that would have a golden halo because I'd sit there and eat everything. But I was always the chunkier of the two of us because I enjoyed my food so much, whereas my sister wasn't fazed. Eating was to fuel her to play more sport, so it wasn't really the pinnacle of her life, whereas I would be thinking what I was going to eat next.
That role that you had of being the good eater, which I also had, that we somehow praise people for that. There are these moral labels, aren't there? I mean, my older two were relatively easy to feed because they both loved food in their different ways. And my youngest was born with cleft palate. The whole business of swallowing was really complicated for him for the first year. And he became a picky eater. But then it's just so easy to fall into that trap of labeling somebody as picky. And then you get into this dynamic where you just think, I'm never, ever, ever going to get out of this. And dinner times should be such a joy. And as any parent will say, they're not always. Liz, you have young kids yourself.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word joy, I don't think, at the moment.
I think you'll get there, though. And they're young still, aren't they?
Yeah. What would your advice be for picky eaters and mums who are worried that their children are not enjoying diverse diets? Not end up with that trap where you're almost standing over them, becomes
with a spoon, on which I quite often was, and I made every mistake in the book, and I should have known better as a food writer. But it's emotional feeding a child. I think the biggest piece of advice would be don't worry about getting it right. Tomorrow is another breakfast, and then this idea of relaxing and just enjoying it a bit more. I know that's really easier said than done, but everything we know about how preferences are formed is that it's exposure, but the exposure only works if it's done in a positive way. So you can get in this kind of catch-22 if you're like, try the broccoli. No, really try the broccoli. And it's just that tension in your voice, even though you're doing it with the best intentions in the world. The two breakthrough things for us were, number one, this technique called tiny tastes, which was pioneered by a scientist I interviewed for the book called Lucy Cook, which sounds too simple to be true, but if you reduce the size of the vegetable being tasted as small as a pea or even a grain of rice, suddenly you haven't got that textural problem. You know, a lot of kids are worried about putting, how's it going to feel in your mouth, not just the taste. You work on one vegetable at a time for a period of a week or 10 days. And every day that they try it, even if they spit it out, you say, well done, great. So I never thought I'd be praising my son for spitting out a mushroom. Yeah. Actually, not even a whole mushroom, a fragment of a mushroom. But then you move on. You're not attempting the whole plate at once. You're not going to run before you can walk. And what we found was that after 3 or 4 days, he was saying, can you give me a bigger bit of this? Because I can't really taste it.
Oh, that's a breakthrough.
And that's a breakthrough. And then you've won. And then the shift you're looking for with food always is that shift from pain to pleasure. And once it's pleasure, once healthy food is pleasure, it's easy. There's no more battles. The second thing, which was I didn't really write about enough in the book, but it was so practical and simple, and it just really seems to have worked for us, was serving the vegetables almost casually as a kind of starter on a saucer, because my pickiest eater was also my slowest eater, and I would find that if I was kind of bustling around the kitchen finishing the cooking, but he was sat there with his little saucer of veg, I'd almost just turn my back. There was no hovering over him with a hard cold spoon demanding that he eat, and suddenly the veg is gone. And it's become like Pavlov's dog. So now I've noticed, he's now 9, if I serve him everything all at once on a plate, which he still can be a little bit funny about, he will go for the veg first, no matter what else is there. It's almost as if he can't. It's a success. It's conditioning. Yeah. Honestly, if you had met my son and me when he was 3 and I was too old, you would not have thought he would ever, ever be that child. You know, it's just, until you've been through it as a parent, you think, how can someone be reduced to tears by one pea?
Yeah, well, there we go. What did you think of that, Rosie?
Really interesting. I was fascinated to learn about the small bites approach, which sounds like a really good way of getting kids into eating slightly different vegetables.
It really is, isn't it? It's like a version of baby steps, I suppose.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one thing we didn't include in this feature was that I used to suffer from an eating condition as well when I was young. I refused to eat. I have no idea why. We talked about this at length, actually, during the interview, but chose to keep it out. But I really could see the value in what she was saying there. I thought
Absolutely.
It was, you know, just really good. And maybe that was something that was used on me. I was just too young to remember really what happened.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, how textures can have so much impact on how children perceive foods.
And yeah, yes. And that's perfectly reasonable, right? We're just going to move on now to the next piece. This is still with Bea Wilson, and we're just going to change topics slightly to talk about diet, cooking skills, and also how our great-grandmothers, they got it right.
Diet is now the number one killer in the world. And that's a bizarre place to have reached. How do we fight our way through this bizarre food supply without then swinging to some opposite extreme of clean eating and say, I'm terrified of all food?
Yes.
It's partly that so few of us are now related to anyone that works on the land. If you look before the Second World War in Britain, there were 500,000 farmers, whereas now it's a tiny segment of the population. Then this kind of sensory disconnect, if you also have people that don't cook, that don't handle food. I mean, I've talked to head teachers who say they meet children that don't know you peel an orange before you eat it. They just, when they're given their free fruit, when they arrive in reception, they just bite into the orange, peel and all.
I think, you know, you've written very well as well on this dichotomy of when in a food of plenty, the great famines are a thing of the past, and we are now not very likely, most of us, to die of starvation, and rather we are actually eating ourselves, if not literally to death, although that is the case also, certainly eating ourselves into ill health. It does seem that the more of it there is, the more plentiful it is, the more removed we are from it in the sense of growing it or touching it or, you know, rearing an animal in order to then slaughter it and kill it. We are encompassing quasi-foods because they have very little to do with real ingredients. And ironically, at a time when we have never had it better when it comes to food, we are actually not enjoying better health. But do you think it's also to do with, you know, how we eat as a family and a cultural difference here in Northern Europe, perhaps, compared to Southern Europe? So I spent quite a lot of time in Italy and I've observed so many scenes where I see how the children firstly don't associate sitting at the table as a chore or something they'd rather avoid. It is just absolutely taken for granted. And they sit for long times without any adult speaking to them necessarily, but they don't seem to mind. And, you know, they're very much part, I think, of the larger context. But also so much of the food that's put on the table is vegetable based, and they as a culture I think have always been largely vegetable based and very seasonal. So if the courgettes are in season, well, there would be courgette every day on the table and there may not be anything else. And I never forget a friend of mine who sat with her two-year-old in her lap, and the two-year-old grabbed a bowl of grated parmesan cheese. She held the bowl and she tipped it to have some, and of course it fell over her face, it was in her hair and her eyelashes, and as I sat opposite the mother, she didn't say anything for a while and then just brushed down the dress and then said, this is great for developing dexterity and I know she loves cheese. Well done, she said to the daughter. Instead of, don't do that, don't play
with
your food.
But that's the enjoyment, isn't it, again? Yes. And actually children like much stronger flavours sometimes than we give them credit for. I mean, parmesan is like pure umami.
Yes, pure umami, yes.
And we know that breast milk is quite umami, in fact. So given the chance, most people will learn to love something like that. But I think you're right. I think it's about enjoyment, taking the pressure off, maybe that thing of, yeah, not feeling everyone's hovering around you waiting for you to eat. But also in Italy, they have this wonderful thing, which I've heard people talk about in Italian schools, of actively trying to cultivate a taste for bitterness in children, seeing that as being something important. If you look at our food supply, well, in Italy as well, but especially in countries like Britain, the US, so much of what we eat is sweet. Like 80% of items for sale in the supermarket have sugar in. And so I think the single most useful thing anyone can do, adult or child, is to expand your palate and unsweeten it slightly. Because again, it's a bit like with the tiny taste of learning to love the vegetables, and then it's very easy to eat the vegetables. If you learn not to enjoy or not to be tempted by such sweet flavours, then it's really easy to walk on by. Whereas I know, as a former compulsive eater, it isn't always that easy. You know, if you're tempted by every donut, there are an awful lot of donuts in today's world. Sales of ultra-processed food in the States have taken a downturn for the very first time.
Well, that's nice to hear.
And people are drinking more water everywhere in the world. I mean, that the vogue for carrying water bottles is making a little bit of a difference. And I think the thing of grandmothers I feel torn about, because I have huge respect for grandmothers and I wish that we all knew how to cook our grandmothers, but I also think, well, we're living in new times and we've somehow got to adjust and develop new cooking skills. And I think some of what we're living with now is that actually we are almost looking at these things like meat and sugar through the celebratory eyes that our grandmothers had for them. And we're not seeing, no, actually, that's not something that's so great anymore.
No.
Evolutionary experts talk about mismatch. So we've kind of got the biology of our great-grandmothers, and we've got this kind of sense that if you can see some meat, eat it very quickly now.
Yes, well,
the problem
well,
is we see meat the whole time. So in a way, that Michael Pollan thing of only eat what your yes. great-grandmother recognises, I think that only gets you so far. Mm-hmm. I do think our great-grandmother's plates were the right size. Mm-hmm. A lot of modern plates are like these vast white mm-hmm. expanse. So sometimes people say, oh, it's all junk food that's fueled obesity, never home-cooked food. Much as I love home-cooked food, I think we also have to be honest about the fact you look at the plates for sale in John Lewis. Mm-hmm. They're huge.
They're massive, yes.
The thing I look at is my wine glasses. I'm sure I'm pouring way, way too much wine. And when I switch and pour wine into a smaller tumbler, even though it's less elegant, it's obviously I drink less. I mean,
yes,
it's a no-brainer.
Absolutely. And so you would eat less from a smaller plate,
you
of course.
Do. Everyone mm. And everyone thinks, but no, that's I wouldn't be tricked by a plate. We're all tricked by plates all the time. You know, I think you should celebrate life. I think you should enjoy dessert. For goodness sake, don't feel guilty after you've had a slice of cake. That would be madness. Otherwise, it's not comfort food, is it? But there are days when I'm really honestly not remotely hungry, but I feel like something sweet, and I eat it out of a ramekin. It doesn't matter what I pile into that ramekin. It could be a huge, well, it can't be huge, but it could be chocolate brownie, it could be halva, it yeah. could be fudge, it could be something really energy dense and wonderful, but I'm not going to overeat it.
No.
So my thing would be we should be eating new, delicious, modern food of the kind you serve here, but on old plates.
I think that's an excellent advice. Well, thank you, Bea, for coming in to talk to us. It was an absolute pleasure to have you here.
It's always lovely to talk to you.
And she was right about the plates, you know. The first time that ever struck me, I went to America when I was a kid, and I remember going to a restaurant with my dad and my sister, and the plates were enormous. Really, really bigger than anything I'd ever seen. I thought, my God, no wonder.
It makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, plate size is a big issue, isn't it, when you're trying to be more aware of your diet.
Yeah, very much
and
so.
And glass size too. I think Bea had a very good point about that.
Mm. Bea's books are all available online and in bookshops. Her most recent one is First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. That was released in 2016. And she's currently hard at work on her next book as we speak. So, yeah, many thanks Bea and Tina and Liz of the Cambridge Cookery and Bistro.
And now on to the Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival. On Wednesday, Alan spoke with Festival Director Heidi White about what's booked up and what's almost sold out, and also about some rather novel events.
There's quite a few now that are looking like they'll sell out in the next few days, actually. Just a reminder, of course, that the Pint Shop Afternoon Teas Brunch is sold out. That sold out really quickly at the start of the ticket sales opening. The Special Edition Mill Road Food Tour is sold out. The La Latina Bustorante supper with the Tostones demo, that's almost sold out on Monday the 21st of May. So if you're quick, there's probably a small handful of tickets left right. for that.
They were wondering about putting on a second night. Are they still considering that?
I haven't
that?
Heard any news on that one. They've been quite overwhelmed with the support of this one, which is great. Which so is... potentially, even after Eat Cambridge, they might run other things like this in the future, which would be amazing. There's the Romano's Paella Masterclass, which we spoke about last time, that's almost sold out. If there's a couple of people or a group of you who want to go, I would say to book that now. That's on Thursday the 24th of May, and that includes the paella cooking demo, cooking the paella yourself with all the ingredients, eating the paella, and then it's taking place in a really nice pub where you can also then buy drinks and dessert. So yeah, that one is close to selling out, and we think it will do. The Steak and Honour and Guerrilla Kitchen event, which we spoke about last time, Bow and Burgers, that's sold out for both sittings on Friday.
And that's on the 1st
Friday
of June.
Friday the 1st of yep. June, yeah. And then lots of other things are nearing sellout, but they still have got a bit of space. The MasterChef pop-up with Giovanna Ryan, the cheese plates on Sunday the 27th of May, I believe is very close to selling out. That's held at Novi. And Novi's own supper club on Thursday the 31st of May, the botanical supper with Gatto Gatto, is also close to selling out.
One of the events we haven't talked about is the Kokofune Edibles Class and Botanical High Tea. What can you say about that?
This sounds like a real treat, I would say, for a Sunday afternoon. It's on the 27th of May, all afternoon and going into the evening. And it's a collaboration between Anna's Flower Farm, a local horticulturist, and Gemma from the Linton Kitchen. And they will be putting on a class, a workshop, quite a hands-on session exploring the use of edible plants and flowers in food, baking, creating a gorgeous high tea using these edibles that they've grown and foraged. So it should be amazing by the sounds of it. It's al fresco, it's in Hodson's Folly, the little historic area next to the River Cam on Koh Fen, which hardly anyone knows about. I imagine, knowing Gemma from the Linton Kitchen, there'll be a beautiful table set up, and then they'll show guests how to actually create this high tea and decorate tables and decorate using plants and flowers. And of course, eat the feast as well. Well, if it's is the point of Eat Cambridge.
Yeah, if it's a nice day, that would be a magical experience.
I know,
and actually, you could go for a quick swim in the Cam while you're at it if you wanted, couldn't you?
There's actually a little landing platform there by Hodson's Folly, I think. I think it was for bathing back in the day.
Yeah, and there was also, I thought, an interesting one on the 31st of May, put on by Culinaris, olive oil and hoppy beer tasting.
Yes, yes.
And you know, olive oil is one of those things that we talk about, we use, we enjoy, but I don't know that there are that many people who are true olive oil aficionados.
Yeah.
In the same way as there are, say, for wine or increasingly for beers.
There's not that many who taste olive oil on a daily basis, although I'm sure in the certain industries there are tasters of olive oil.
I'm sure there
and
are.
I think that's what the event will touch upon, how to taste the qualities in the different olive oil.
Because they are so different. And I wonder how many people have a whole range of different olive oils in their house.
I must say, I'm
house.
Getting towards that.
Well, I can brag of five.
Yeah, I thought it was a touch of food snobbery with me that I kept moving on to different brands or trying different oils, rapeseed oils I particularly like. But actually, when I found out about this event with Culinaris and Thirsty, I realised there is a topic there actually to be explored. And it's not just the difference between extra virgin and olive oil, for example. There's a whole range of different variants and different tastes and flavours, and they're matching it with hoppy beers, which is really interesting because I believe the different beers will bring out different flavours in the olive oil.
Fascinating.
I know. So yeah, that's on the 31st of May. That one's taking place at Thirsty, hosted with Culinaris. Culinaris are actually doing a couple of events where they've paired up with booze purveyors to match food, so yeah, it should be really interesting.
It should indeed.
Right. There are still spaces.
And one of the things, Heidi, that we haven't talked about, I think we've talked about most of the things in Eat Cambridge, but one of the things we haven't talked about is for the main event on the 19th of May, a special festival beer.
A festival beer has been brewed for the first time ever. We have an Eat Cambridge festival beer, which is quite fitting because the Cambridge Beer Festival then follows on from Eat Cambridge. So we like to get involved with what's happening locally. The beer is an exclusive brew created by the Pint Shop and Brew Board, who are based in Harston. So they've been working away behind the scenes quite a few weeks ago now, coming up with the flavours, brewing it at the brewery in Harston. And then it will be canned, I believe, in some unique one-off packaging, especially for us, and then it will be available on the 19th of May for the first time at Pint Shop. You'll be able to sample it throughout the festival, and I believe that Brew Board will bring it to the festival, the main event itself, as well on the 19th of May.
Well, I look forward to trying some.
Yeah, me too.
Maybe next year somebody will do a festival olive oil.
Yeah, I think they should.
Right, okay, thanks very much,
Heidi.
Thanks.
Yeah, some really good events coming up there. Are you a bit of an olive oil aficionado, Rosie?
I wouldn't describe myself as an aficionado, no. But I love a nice infused olive oil. Maybe a bit of garlic or rosemary in there. It's always good for cooking.
Seems nice, yeah. Yep. And that music signals time for the latest food tweets from the city. So, Food Cycle are at it again today. They are serving a three-course dinner starting right now at the Wesley Methodist Church. Swede and parsnip soup to start with, crouton bean ragu with rosemary potatoes and rainbow salad to follow, finish off with a lovely chocolate banana oaty slice with fruit salad and custard. Sounds great, right?
That sounds absolutely delicious. And speaking of delicious, La Latina Bustorante are offering a summer fruit and mascarpone cake today. I've just seen a picture of it on Twitter. It looks absolutely dazzling. They're open from 12 till 9 p.m.
Alimentum has just tweeted with another new dish on their menu, smoked ham hock, chicken liver and watercress. Now, Samira Effer is the new head chef there. She was actually on Flavour a couple of episodes ago. She was chatting with Tina and Liz at the Cookery and Bistro. I wonder if this is one of the fruits of her labours. If you fancy the sound of this, you can book online at restaurantalimentum.co.uk.
Lovely. I've noticed also the Gog Magog Farm Shop are hiring. So they are looking for front of house, kitchen assistants and a dishwasher. And if you're interested in any of those positions, you can email them hello@thegog.com.
Now, almond oat milk and cold brew coffee. These are two of the latest trends in the coffee world. And Coffee World is where I headed to next.
Would you like a drink? Some Irish coffee, specialty of the house. My own mother's recipe.
That's very kind of you. I'd love it.
I'll be back in a jiffy.
This is a coffee plant. It actually starts life as a red cherry. From that, it contains two seeds, the coffee beans. A lot of people believe it's grown in the ground as beans, but actually it's grown on a tree. And these are then hand-picked. The two seeds are then removed, which then come to us as green beans, which are then roasted and give us the coffee beans that we know.
Coffee World is Cambridge's first roastery. This is sales manager Craig Jackson.
Started in Cambridge in 1984, down on Maudlin Street, and then moved out to Newmarket because we needed more room, but always with the view of come back to Cambridge. When this unit in Milton became available, it was absolutely perfect. Found ourselves with a lot of space to use.
See, Johnny, you got to go again too.
We're looking at a black and white photo in the foyer here. This is Ari, who started the business way back then, and he's standing in front of one of the grinders.
Roasters. So that was our original roaster. It was a Probat, 25 kilos. Long retired now. The roaster itself, yeah. We've always drum roasted our coffees, and just the weight of the drum that the coffee actually goes into would be very, very sizable. Obviously, it's still a family-run business. Now, Ali's sons that run it.
Ali's sons, Mohammed and Salah.
And your father began this 30-odd years ago?
Yeah, he began it, yeah. With a little shop down Magdalen Street, just roasting for public. And then slowly grew through cafes asking him for coffee.
Yeah, Ali was ahead of his time, you know. First coffee roaster in Cambridge, the only person really, you know, doing it. Supplying good quality coffee, you know, trying to change people's perspective back in the 80s.
Do you know what got him into it in the first place? Was he a general kind of foodie kind of guy?
He was, yeah. He had a delicatessen before the cafe.
Yeah.
And he just done it for a hobby.
But it's only recently that you've started focusing on the public, because I think you supplied only to large companies. But now you have this front of house where people can come in, learn more about the coffee, they can do barista training and so on.
Mm-hmm. On the right, as you come in, we've got the showroom, which showcases all our machinery range. Cold brews on a big generation, we've got that. And then on the left, our retail shop, which just enables members of the public to come down, sample some of the single origin coffees we've got, along with some of the more artisan brew kit.
They've got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil.
And in here, as you would expect, the first thing I guess most people's eyes are going to be drawn to is the line of different roasts you've got here. They're different colours when we describe things like bright acidity. Mm-hmm. So the average layman, what does bright acidity mean?
So basically, with any coffee bean that's been roasted from around the world, they'll come with their own unique flavour profile. Yeah. Varies greatly from country to country, or to do with altitude, origin, but also within the same country, you can get two very different tasting coffee beans. Up on the tubes at the moment, we've got...
He's referring to large, transparent tubes nailed to the wall, full of coffee beans. They sound like this.
We've got three African coffees.
Yeah.
The Ethiopian, the Kenyan, the Rwandan. Of those three, they're very different. Yirgacheffe, the Ethiopian at the end, is very well known. Sweet, fruity, floral coffee with lots of tones of citrus. And that'll be slightly lighter roasted.
It says black tea on there as well.
Yeah. When we get this, so we have a flavour wheel of how you taste coffee. You start with one category, say fruit. That then dials in, and you'll go to either sort of citrus, berry, and then you'll go even further, and you'll take notes such as blackberry or lemon, as opposed to, you know, just citrus. So that's just what's been dialed in from them. So most of our coffees are medium roasted, medium to dark, especially with the single origins that you see up here. We always try and carry at least 7 or 8. We would have had 9, but the Peruvian sold out. It's been a fantastic coffee that has gone out to many people as a guest. We actually took slightly darker just to bring out some of the more chocolate notes within it.
Damn good coffee and hot.
So medium to dark is what's popular?
Generally, yeah. I mean, light roast is quite an individual taste. You'll get a lot of speciality roasters looking at light roasts. From that, you often get a lot more flavour, potentially some of the citrus notes, as opposed to the darker, where you get that stereotypical strong, punchy coffee. Yeah. The darker the roast, generally, that's where it starts to go with that. So.
I want to see where the coffee is made, so I hold up my recorder and tell Craig that I want to do some sound effects.
Do you want to do that in the roastery?
Okay.
Yeah? We'll take you back, I'll take you back there. Okay. And through it through there, thank you. So obviously we roast all of our coffee on site.
Yeah.
We don't buy anything in roasted, all as green bean. So this is where the magic happens. I know what the noise is, it's the drum turning.
I ask Craig if I can take a photo of the roaster.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And with a smile. There you go. Yeah, so this is our bulk roaster. This does our main blends. We've got origins from all over the world. Brazilian, Colombian, Guatemalan, Honduras, Ethiopian, Mexican. Generally, the coffee comes in 60 kilo Hessian sacks, taken up by air through that tube into the hopper.
What's a hopper?
So a hopper is such a holding chamber. Once the drum is at temperature, the hopper then lets the beans in and then down and through the distoner, because you do get foreign objects in coffee. The odd piece of wood, the odd little stone, and that picks up on all of that because it wreaks havoc with grinders. So yeah, well, you don't want to go through there. That's where the dungeon is.
Okay.
That's just where the engineers fix machines. So,
black coffee, I'm in trouble. Black coffee, I see double. How am I gonna get home?
Black There's been three great waves of coffee. The post-war coffee boom, that introduced super strong Italian coffees, and it brought in instants. In the 60s, that was the second wave. Higher quality coffees were around, Starbucks introduced espressos, and now we are deep through the third wave. This involves lots of delicate, light coffees, as people's coffee tastes grow ever more sophisticated. If you look around town, there's coffee shops everywhere. It wasn't like this 15 years ago. And for Coffee World, things are going well.
Never roasted as much coffee weekly as we are.
Roasting
more and more each week to keep up with demand. So yeah, that's great. It's almost quite easy to work out how our business is going.
Yeah.
By how much coffee we're roasting.
Yeah.
The roaster's been fired up a couple more times this week. You know, a certain type, or we've roasted a certain type of bean, or we track it on the ordering. It's actually really easy to see how our business is going.
A lot of different origins are coming in as well.
Yeah.
So we experiment a lot more with different coffees.
And by having the retail shop and being able to sell directly to the public from there, you know, we can keep them going. So we know that we can roast off a certain amount of, say, the Kenyan.
Mm.
And it's not going to sit in a warehouse or anything like that. It's actually accessible to the public. That's why we get the green bean and we roast it ourselves.
To the future!
They keep a close eye on future trends.
A really major rise at the moment of oat milk, almond milk,
yes,
being used. Yeah. Craig, I keep getting asked for almond milk lattes.
And Craig reckons the big hit of this summer will be cold brew coffee.
Something that we knew was coming.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these things start off in Seattle. Seattle's the home of coffee in America. We're seeing all sorts already, you know, cold brew coffee with almond milk that wasn't available last year, but due to consumer demand, we have to be able to be, you know, proactive on that. Reactive, generally in this industry, you've missed it. For a family-run business that's been going for over 30 years,
We are really, really modern with the times, and you have to be. You really have to be. Coffee, man, they got a gang of coffee in Brazil.
So, cool beans?
Yeah, cool beans.
Good.
Coffee World's products can be found in cafes and places around the city. They do unique blends for some cafes too. And they also do roughly 3 classes a week of barista training, and that's bookable online via the Cambridge Coffee Academy. They have plenty to see, taste and buy for all members of the public. So that's Coffee World. They're just over the big roundabout in Milton. There's even a cycle route that takes you pretty much right outside their door. That's the way I got there. So yeah, really convenient, eh?
Now it's time for news of free food available now in Cambridge, which you can find on the Olio app.
Yeah, now Donna is offering 4 organic beef stock pots. They're made by Callow. They're gluten-free. They're just a little bit past their best before date. And Donna is based around about the King's Hedges way. And also, Alan will like this one. There's a person called Shinty. He is offering strong white active sourdough starters. Perfect for making your own sourdough bread. And for anyone interested, it's 80 grams per portion and it comes in a glass jar. Shinty is also just off the King's Hedges Road near Orchard Park. So that's the Olio app. Free food for everyone.
Amazing.
It's really good, isn't it?
First time I've heard about it. Fantastic.
Well, just when you thought it was safe to go into the garden, it turns out that there are diseases and pests still about. And here is Dave Fox, our resident gardener from Trumpington Allotments, talking about how to deal with them without using pesticides.
Dave, lovely warm weather recently. And I guess that brings pests, disease, does it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it'll also bring crops, you know, on the positive side. So I suppose one thing to say is that, don't get too worried about pests and diseases until you see them. But when you do see them, take action. That's the point, really. So, you know, intervene as soon as the...
I wanted to ask you about. What action should we take?
Well, usually squish between thumb and forefinger is my first thing. So I found my first asparagus beetle yesterday. All over my young asparagus plants. They're the sort of 2 and 3 year old plants, which are just getting established. So I probably killed 100 asparagus beetle, and then there was a similar number on there this lunchtime when I went again. So we can go and have a look and see if you want.
Yeah, let's go and see if there's any.
And I'm just looking for a little yellow and black, quite an attractive little yellow and black beetle actually.
What's that?
There you go, well spotted. Aha! Alan's my new asparagus beetle spotter. So there it is. 8 millimetres long, clear black stripe down the centre, brown head, yellow and black colouring, squished between thumb and forefinger.
And
once you see one, of course, then you see dozens of others.
You get your eye in.
Yeah, absolutely. As with a lot of pests, you stare for several minutes and then suddenly they become visible. So every adult that we get rid of now is not going to produce eggs and larvae, and it's the larvae that actually do the damage. They're a really ugly sort of grey larvae with a dark greyish black head, and they eat away and destroy a lot of the foliage, which weakens the plant for the next year. So it can really delay the establishment of asparagus, which sort of famously is slow to get going. You don't really crop it until the third or fourth year. Oh yeah, there's a couple of other things we can look at. There's the field beans, which have developed very early in my case. So they're basically the same as broad beans in cultivation, and they may well have the black fly. We've had 4 or 5 really nice warm days now, which is classic black fly territory. Normally I wouldn't expect them till late May, but with this sort of weather, we could well find them. So shall we go and have a look? So here's a lovely crop of field beans. Nice plants, good 3 foot tall with loads of flowers on, and this is my crop that I'm going to keep for seed. I want to grow more green manures in future, so I'm saving up my field beans. The black fly, it's the adult, it's a winged aphid, and that will come along and start to reproduce. The young ones are the ones that do all the damage. So there's a couple of key signs, the first of which is ants crawling up and down the tops of the stem and investigating these little dark, almost black patches on the leaves around the growing tip of the plant. And I always wonder whether the ants get a little bit confused here, whether they think that those black spots might be the black fly, or whether it might be that those black spots are sweet and so they have the same sort of honeydew. Because what the ants are doing, they're looking for black flies to sort of farm, so they get the excreta from the aphid and live off that and sort of protect the black fly while they're at it. So can you see, Alan? I'll probably just nip off that leaf so you can see it from your angle. So you can see the wings, you notice. Can you see just above my fingernail there?
Yes.
Two adult.
Yes.
Black fly squished. They won't be reproducing anymore. They're reproducing incredibly quickly, this pest. So you want to, and there's no hope of going through this crop and squishing the lot. So the treatment is rather more brutal. So you take hold of the top couple of inches of the plant and nip it out. Just like literally break off the top of the plant, and that's where all the black fly will be.
The tender part.
Yeah, I mean, it's in common with a lot of pests. They attack the tender part of the plant, which is where the youngest material, where they're going to be able to break through quickest, and also where the plant is pumping up its sap. Good bit is that you can peel off the outer leaves and then eat the...
Yes.
That's not bad. So, there you go, that's the black fly dealt with.
Uh-huh.
So this is a bed of overwintered onions, varieties Radar, I think. So they went in as onion sets in September, October, and I covered them with this Enviro mesh. The idea is that keeps away the dreaded Allium leaf miner, which is the pest that destroyed all our onions last year. Now, I'm slightly concerned that some of these plants might already have been infested by the time I covered them, but we'll have a look and see if we can see any evidence of damage. So I'm just removing a couple of these iron bars that are holding the mesh down.
So what do you look for then?
Twisted leaves. Badly twisted and distorted leaves now. Ah, here we go. See this lower... There's a lower leaf here. That looks characteristic of the type of damage. And there's a little hole there in the leaf. So I'm wondering whether that onion has had an egg laid and the larva burrowing into it. I think that's a perfectly healthy onion.
Yes, it looks all right. It's not squidgy.
No,
either.
That's right. And there's no brown marks. You might expect to see a sort of vertical or diagonal mark where the little sod's burrowed in through the leaf and into the developing bulb. But find the pest. Anyway, that's good news. It suggests possibly that this net has at least kept the pest off so far. Oh yeah, another thing to look out for, I suppose, is the strawberries. The strawberries are well in flower now. The big danger to them is frost now. So if you've got, if you've got strawberries flowering, think about getting ready to protect them with some fleece. I shall try and do that if I see the forecast of frost, because it kills the flowers, stops the fruit falling. Shall we?
Right, so apple trees, what happens with apple trees then that you don't want?
Well, for the last few years, when I was ill, the codling moth got established in my orchard area. There's a moth which comes on the wing about now, maybe usually late May, it says, but we've had a very warm period, so maybe they'll be out by now. And after mating, the females will lay their eggs on or near the developing fruitlets. And then when it hatches, the maggot burrows into the fruit and then gets larger, leaves a larger hole on exiting, because it's eaten quite a lot of your fruit by that stage, and thus damage that almost invariably in my case seems to lead to the fruit rotting, if not on the tree, then very shortly after in store, so I get to eat very few of them. It goes for a few of the pears as well, but most of the apples.
Right. So, and squishing is not the solution?
Not an option. Well, I can't find them, so I've got a three-phase strategy to try and get my apple trees back on track. Firstly, I've been clearing around the base of the trees quite enthusiastically through the winter. You can see there's not a lot of weed growth around any of them, and that's because I've been wanting to make sure that the birds can get at the pupa of the codling moth, well, any other pests as well, but specifically the codling moth, to try and reduce the population. And we're about to start phase two of the strategy, which is to hang up these pheromone-scented specialist traps, which are specifically designed for these winged pests, and this one is sold by, you know, garden supplies with a pheromone lure and a sticky trap. With the idea of that is that the male adults get attracted to the scent and have a sticky end instead of a successful mating.
instead of a compliant female.
You've got certainly a very optimistic male comes to a very unfortunate end. So wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy. Well, I would wish it on my worst enemy, because right now the worst enemy is the coddling moth. So, and if I find any little moths stuck in there, then I've got several of these traps, so I'll get the rest out and put them up. But I won't put the others up until I start actually catching the adult male coddling moth. And then I mentioned this was a three-stage strategy, and that I've just discovered there's a nematode type control that you can use in the autumn to get at the larva as the heavy apple-filled larva fall to the ground and pupate there, and that's where they overwinter. So there's a nematode control for them that you can buy and dissolve in water and water on around the plants. So
some biological control.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, so I should be trying that as well. I really want to get on top of this.
Yeah.
On top of this pest.
Yeah. Right. Good. Anything else you're fighting against at the moment?
Right now, what else are we looking out for? So it's clearing old crops, so pulling out the old brassicas and anything that's finished cropping now.
You've mentioned in the past potatoes and potato blight.
Good point, yes. The problem is that having dug up the crop last year, inevitably one or two little potatoes get left in the ground.
And if there's been blight the previous year, then those potatoes will be at risk of carrying.
And there will have been blight the previous year, so it's potatoes that are carrying that, or, you know, potentially some other disease. I mean, blight's the one we always go on about, isn't it? There's any number of diseases of potatoes, so.
And there's nothing that can be done to prevent the other blight, tomato blight?
Not really, no. I mean, I think tomatoes grown undercover have got a good chance of not catching it for two reasons. Firstly, that they may not get exposed to the spores just because they're in an enclosed space. But secondly, because they're generally kept much drier. So the potato blight, it's a water mould. It spreads in sort of humid conditions in a certain temperature range. Now, outside, if it's raining outside, if there's a lot of dew, then it's going to spread. But inside, maybe you can direct your watering, and you should direct your watering at the base of a tomato rather than on the leaves to minimise the chance of the conditions being right for it to spread.
Mm. People put down plants such as French marigold, don't they, in and amongst their vegetables. What does that do?
That's a type of French marigold which has got a really strong aroma. I mean, it's especially strong in the evening, but that acts as a deterrent to a lot of winged insect pests. So that's a good one. They're quite pretty too. I mean, they're not as showy as a marigold sold as a flower as such. But definitely worth growing.
We have talked about this before, but it was a long time ago. Are you? I think very much doubt the effectiveness of planting or sowing, I should say, carrots alongside onions in order to reduce carrot root fly.
Well, I've doubted it in the past, Alan, but this year I have sown them. And so what I did was just sowed carrots in the middle of the bed and then sprinkled spring onion seed around the edge.
Well, we'll see. So we'll see.
Let's keep an eye on
You can report
this
back later in the year.
come back in a month or two and we'll see.
That was Dave Fox, and he'll be back in 4 weeks' time unless the squidge rise up and get him.
The familiar sound of Booker T and the MG's Green Onions brings us to the Cambridge Food and Drink News, of course, and we always begin this section with jobs.
Franco Manca, the sourdough pizza company that's coming to Market Street, has a number of vacancies, including waiting staff, pizza chef and an assistant manager. If you're interested, apply via the Franco Manca website, where you can find more details.
Trinity in Trinity Street is looking for a chef de partie. You can phone Cambridge 322 130 if you're interested.
Cambridge Cookery and Bistro have on the 19th of May a masterclass called Essential Patisserie with Javier Cavantes. That's on from 11 till 3 and costs £150. To book, go to the Cambridge Cookery website.
And on the 10th of June, there is a plant swap to which everyone is welcome. It's at Trumpington Allotments off Foster Road, and it begins at noon. You can make a small donation if you have nothing to swap.
Looking further ahead, from the 22nd to the 24th of June at Wimpole Hall is the Wimpole History Festival. History-loving foodies will be delighted to know that in attendance will be Azahar Street Food, Boxtrot Selling Tacos, Cambridge Cider Company, Chip Chip Hooray, The Gin Trailer, Gorilla Kitchen, Jack's Gelato, Moonshine Brewery, Rural Coffee Project, Wandering Yak, and the Wood-Fired Wonders, who sell pizza from a converted Land Rover. The old rectory restaurant, the Farm Cafe, and the Stables Cafe will also be serving. Sounds like a food festival with a bit of history attached. And it's at Wimpole Hall from the 22nd to the 24th of June. Wine, wine, wine.
And finally, and quickly, we delve into the wine bin, Rosie.
This Sunday at Elementum in Hills Road, there's another wine club organised by head sommelier Maxwell Allwood. This one is New Wave South African Wines. Book via reservations at restaurantelementum.co.uk.
And to round us off, there is a wine and dine evening at Robinson College on the 31st of May, celebrating English wines. Tickets are available on their website. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Flavour. We will be back on the 26th of May at noon, as usual. And you can expect our podcast early next week, available via our website or via iTunes, or in fact any podcast service. And Rosie, it's been really great to have you back on the show.
Oh, thanks, Matt. It's been a while.
Yeah. Well, how are things going over at Bums on Seats?
Very good. I'm back on the show on the 19th of May, where I'm pretty sure we're going to be covering Deadpool 2. So a lot of fans looking forward to that one. Not sure what the other films are yet, but we'll see. So yeah, it's always good to get into some in-depth analytics on films, even ones like Deadpool 2.
Well, we do like some cross-pollination antics of crew members on Cambridge 105.
Yeah.
And well, I think Dave Fox, our gardener, would approve of that, as would Alan. If you want to get in touch with any news or comment when we're off air, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, or you can contact us on Twitter @flavour105.
Until we're back on the 26th of May, from Matt and myself, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.